Hi, I'm James.
And I'm Anthony.
And this is Words and Numbers. What is, Anthony, that wonderful thing that you've got in your brain that you have decided is both new and exciting this week?
Even I don't know that this is exciting, but it is new, and it's at least caused me to repeatedly think about this. You've heard of quiet quitting? I keep seeing articles about this. You don't quit your job, you just scale back to do what's required. You don't go above and beyond.
Let's just say that I understand.
I had to think about this for a while. At first, I equated it with what I would call shirking, but then the economist to me says, well, no, hang on. If you, the worker, have engaged in a contract with an employer, and the contract says you're supposed to do A, B, and C, and you do A, B, and C, and let's say you even do it well, to do D, E, and F as well, it's beyond the contract. Why would you do that? Now, employers will do this thing, and it irks me every time I hear it. They'll say things like, this business is a family. The implication being that you give it your all. Yeah, it's a family as long as they want you to give more than what you're contractually obligated to give. But the minute it comes time to lay off somebody, all of a sudden it's not a family.
You can't fire family. You have to just deal with it.
I think we have this work ethic that comes down from our parents and grandparents of, you know, you do your best at a job, you give it your all. And I can understand all of that. But if you're going to go beyond what you are contracted to do, the employer then would have to, by symmetry, go beyond what he's promised to pay you. And that does happen. You get jobs that involve bonuses at the end of the year, and that I can see. You go above and beyond what's required of you, and the employer in turn goes above and beyond what's required of the employer in terms of paying you. But for jobs that don't include bonuses like that, I have come to the point of not seeing a moral argument for giving more than what you contracted to give.
It used to be the case that every employer gave Christmas bonuses, and then it just slowly ramped down. And what also ramped down were bonuses for any other kind of thing, too, unless they were contractually specified. If you sell H number of units, we will give you I bonus.
Take all of that and apply it to tipping. And all of a sudden, you've got something very uncomfortable that the contractual arrangement when I go into a restaurant is that I pay what's listed on the menu. There is no contractual relationship to tip.
I think that's wrong. I think that's very incorrect.
No, but there is no contractual relationship. That's very clear.
No, I don't think it's clear at all.
Tell me why.
Because it's an unspoken rule, amore, if you want to call it that, that the price of the entree is money that's going to the restaurant owner. But if you had the nerve to sit down in a place where they have waitresses and waiters, it's an unwritten, unspecified contract that you will tip them. How much is the interesting question? I waited tables for a grand total of 3 days, and I've been a chronic over-tipper ever since. I'm going to tip well over 20% as a rule. But 15, I get it. 15%, double the tax in most jurisdictions, is what people usually do. But notice, nobody walks into a restaurant and doesn't tip. That's how you know it's an unwritten contract.
Yeah, I've got a problem with the phrase unwritten contract, which well, you're describing. Call it amore if you like, or an expectation, but it's not a contract.
You know, I'm not going to get lost in semantic argument here. I think everybody knows what's expected.
Granted. However, we're getting off of my point. My point is not to make an argument against tipping. Rather, it's to say, look, suppose your waiter did the absolute minimum. That is, what's his job? His job is to take your order, bring you food. And suppose that's what the person did. That's it. There's no small talk. There's no checking up on you, any of that business. The worker is behaving the way we think about quiet quitting, doing exactly what he was contracted to do. I think most reasonable people would look at that and say, why does this guy deserve a tip? He hasn't done anything. And what actually happens is more what you're describing of, yes, almost everybody gives a tip, but also on the other side, waiters and waitresses, almost to a person, will go above and beyond what's contractually required for them to do the job.
And we've all had the experience of a terrible waiter.
Right.
And I have had waiters, maybe two in my entire life, who got no tip whatsoever from me. And more than that, they got an explanation of why they got no tip from me, which is even worse than not tipping, right? You stand around,
you
stand
you get
around
a scolding from James.
That's right. You get yelled at because you were a lousy waiter. But usually, if it's marginal service, you get the standard 15. Whereas if somebody really went the extra mile, my tip level grows to 25 or even 30%.
Interestingly, you describe 15% as standard. My understanding is it's 20% has become standard.
Well, it has been, but I don't treat it that way.
When I was a kid, 10% was standard.
Yeah, that's right.
And someone might look at that and say, well, yeah, but inflation. Except, no.
No.
It's a percentage of the bill. Inflation's already in there.
That's right. We've already taken care of inflation. This is a new expectation. As far as I'm concerned, that expectation crests at 15%.
I've come from first encountering quiet quitting and thinking that this is tantamount to breach of contract. And then the more I think about it, the more I think, no, actually, it's the other way around. It's adhering to the contract.
I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other on that. I do have a strong feeling on the thing I want to talk about this weekend. Guns bought through credit cards in the U.S. will now be trackable.
Ooh, look at that. It was always trackable before. What must have changed is the government's requiring credit card companies to submit paperwork on this.
Well, yeah, and here's the thing I didn't know about. There's this thing called the International Organization for Standardization.
Never heard of it.
Let me say that again. The International Organization for Standardization. This ISO, as it's known, voted in favor of creating a merchant code for firearm stores. Now there's a special code that they have to use. And it will be really easy for the government to peer into both sides of the equation on that code. All of a sudden, the United States government is going to have a list of every person who brought a gun from every place he could have bought it.
You can pay cash, at least until you can't.
And you had exactly the same snotty read on it that I had, that it's just going to be a matter of time now before the government says, oh, and by the way, you cannot buy a firearm with cash.
Yes.
I see that happening down the road at some point. Every single transaction has to be markable in a way that cash wouldn't allow. Regardless of whether you like guns, you should be very upset at what's happening right now.
I find it useful to think about the foot in the door. Even those who are in favor of this thing, okay, let's track down the guns, think to yourself, what is it that you buy that perhaps you'd like other people not to know that you buy? Because once the precedent is set, it's more easily extended to all sorts of other things.
Keep in mind that this isn't just a list of items that might be dangerous. This is a list of items that is probably embarrassing. And every single person has the list in his head of what would in fact be embarrassing. I don't want to trot any of my examples out any more than you would want to trot yours.
We don't have that much time, James.
We really don't. Well, I mean, look, I'm shameless. So I would say these things, and I would say, and you all should admire me ever more because these things are true. But I understand that people like you, men of low character, might have lists of things that you would be horrified to have your wife find out about, for example. Or any number of other people, or the people at work. This is why we have a private life distinction. There are certain things that we all say should be off limits to everyone in the world unless we decide otherwise. And this walks us down the road that puts that to bed for the rest of all time. This is often the case. We see this kind of thing hit, and we say, you should all be very worried. And then people respond, why should I be worried? I don't think anybody should have guns in the first place. No kidding, Bocephus. That's not really the point. Mm-hmm. The real point here is that if you let it happen with something you don't care about, it will happen with something you do care about. And why people have such a hard time getting that, I'll never understand. Now, it happens to be the case that I do care about guns. I think it's pretty safe to say you do too. Understand that that bias works on what we're saying, but my bias is towards freedom, not towards guns.
And that's not the foolishness?
Oh, not even close. That was a few years back. I think it was back before the world got sick. We started talking about what Americans were spending their money on. Again, to the headline, Americans spent more on taxes in 2021 than on food, clothing, and healthcare combined.
That's jarring. Your biggest line item is taxes.
Food should be.
Food or shelter.
Food should be the big one here. And obviously they didn't put shelter in because I don't think people spent more on shelter than they did on taxes. But healthcare? After everything that we've been told for years Apparently, healthcare is not the big problem the government wants us to understand it to be. The government is the big problem the government
Imagine that.
Doesn't tell us about. I mean, for f***'s sake, how did we get here that these year after year after year tell us to be worried and afraid about how much X and Y cost, only to find out that those cost so much more, it's not even funny. Man, f*** those people. You got to be kidding me.
And we can all see why it's fun to get James riled up.
I think my outburst is concluded. What a bunch of liars. We know, Aunt, that politicians lie. I mean, everybody knows that. But the degree to which these lie about everything is just ridiculous.
For an extra $5 donation to Words and Numbers, I'll send you the video of James' rant.
Well, we are recording that, aren't we? Well, all you see is my forehead, right? The microphone takes up most of my head.
Yeah, it's bouncing up and down, getting redder and redder.
And you see the forehead with one giant protruding vein right up the front.
He's gesticulating all over the place.
I mean, look, this is just ridiculous, right? God, I want to go punch every one of them.
This is my entertainment for the week.
How did I spend more on taxes than in food, clothing, and healthcare combined? I'm hungry, my clothes all don't fit, and I'm in ill health. I spent a lot of money on these things.
I have something not foolish. I want to talk about mugs.
Oh, right, because I got another 100 emails.
We had a contest asking listeners to guess how many ounces of pipe tobacco James has. I got a bunch of emails. Almost all of them were in the hundreds of ounces. Only one went over the correct number. The correct number is 1,726.5 ounces. And for those of you who do the math, that's over 100 pounds of tobacco that James has sitting around his office. Thomas Wright guessed 4,073 ounces, which was one of only two four-digit guesses, but he goes over, so he doesn't count. The winner is Evan Davies, no relation, who guessed 1,527. He actually came pretty close.
That's actually really close, isn't it? My favorites were the ones that were coming in like 40 ounces. If I can fit it into a big gulp cup, come on, that's not the right answer.
So, Evan, if you would email your address to wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com, I'll be happy to send you a mug.
Congratulations, Evan.
Now, we have to give a mug for this week, and I propose another contest. This one will be easier than guessing James Tobacco. First person to email in the correct name of the voice actor who read the audible version of Cooperation and Coercion, our wonderful book that you should all purchase.
But they could just go look that up. What kind of competition is that?
I know they can do that. That's why I said it was easier. Be the first to send in the correct name, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
To get more Ant and James, buy a copy of our excellent book, Cooperation and Coercion. You can find the paper and electronic versions on Amazon and the audio version on Audible. If you'd like to support Words and Numbers, make your way over to patreon.com/wordsandnumbers, where you can contribute to our podcast-making habits. If you'd like to schedule us to come speak at your event, be it corporate or educational, or have James officiate at your wedding, send us an email at wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
This is the weird thing that happens with time. At some point, you lose all track of it and it doesn't exactly matter anymore. When we were young, half years mattered. How old are you? I'm 9 and a half.
Right.
So much closer to 10, right? So much closer.
I think it's due to the fact that when you're 10 years old, a year is 10% of your life.
Mm-hmm.
When you're 50, it's 2% of your life.
It's even more than that because, yeah, it's 10% of your life. But what about your sentient life? You probably didn't start building real memories until you were at least 3.
Right.
Time takes on a different appearance when you sit back and really think about it. Certain ages were so important to me when I was a boy. When I was 8, I found a science kit. Do you remember those? Mm-hmm. I found a science kit in a department store, and I picked it up, and I brought it to my mother, and I said, I want this, please. And she said, oh, no. And I said, but I want it. And she said, you're going to try and blow things up. And I said, well, yeah, that's what a science kit is for.
Yeah.
And she said, you can have that when you're 10. 3 days after my 10th birthday, we were in a store. I grabbed the same thing. I brought it up. I said, I'll take this now, please. I'm 10. And she couldn't believe that I remembered this.
Yeah.
The next one was 13, remember? And now you're a teenager.
Mm-hmm.
All my Jewish friends were having bar mitzvahs, right? There's this obvious point in your life that's just somehow different. And unlike my Jewish friends, my parents didn't consider me an adult. And truth be told, my friend's Jewish parents didn't either. But you take the point. And then it was 16 when I could drive. And I was at the DMV, pounded on that door the minute they opened. I had all the forms filled out and I'm ready to roll. And Aunt, you've known me for a long time. How many times have I ever been anywhere willingly at 9 a.m.?
Yeah, at 9 a.m., absolutely not.
And there it was. And then all of a sudden, you're 20. Mm-hmm. You're into your second decade. And then 21, and you're an adult.
I think there's a big difference between what young people think of when they think of becoming adult and what adults think of when they think of young people becoming adults. And so the young people say, well, 16, I should be an adult at 16 because why, I can drive, or 18 because I can vote, or 21 because I can legally drink, or whatever it is. But as an adult, I look on kids in front of me in the classroom, even those that are junior, senior level, we're talking about 20-year-olds, sometimes 21-year-olds, and I think, my God, they're children.
Yeah, they're like embryos.
And yet, they're making decisions like, well, they've already made decisions to take on debt for college loans, but they're making decisions about getting married or what jobs to take. And I think back to myself when I was 16, looking up to someone who was 21, and I thought, oh, wow, that's a wise person.
They got it all together.
Someone who's been around the block. That's a real adult.
They got everything figured out. Turns out my decisions at 21 were roughly as bad as they were at age 16.
Yeah.
And that's just it. Most of these rules are designed to save young people from their bad urges.
But there's evidence now that the human brain keeps developing into the 20s.
Yeah.
So there's actually something physiologically to be said for the fact that you actually aren't a full adult at early 20s.
Right. And here's where it gets really interesting, because every single thing that we regulate by age, the age that we choose is always arbitrary.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of has to be. If you're going to think about driving at 16, some people at age 16 are very, very much on top of their game. Others are incredibly reckless. I was reckless. Boy, did I total some cars when I was younger.
Yeah, same here.
Yeah, and of course I did. But then if I think about it, I missed on the 18-year-old drinking, but I did make it to the 18-year-old smoking, and I smoked like a chimney for years by the time I was 18. And boy, I thought that was the greatest thing in the world. And truth be told, Aunt, I miss it every day. And you keep walking down this line, and every single age you pick is an arbitrary line, but you've got to have something to use as a standard. And then you drop this bomb right in the middle of a consideration like this. And I think you're right too, because it does seem like the human brain is still in development by age 26. And there are all kinds of things you could do, you know, like drinking and smoking, or vaping if these people are to be believed, or drug using if those people are to be believed, that will hamper the brain's development. And all of a sudden, you just gave us a non-arbitrary line. We could actually say, sure, 26 it is.
Yeah.
But oh my God, are you kidding me? Are we going to treat people like children until they're 26?
Well, that's what we've been doing. What did we do back in 2008? But to say that everyone up to age, I think it was 26, if not 27, can be on their parents' health insurance.
Yeah, I think it was 24 or 26. So let's just congregate around 26 and call it even. Most people won't care about that because it doesn't actually cost them anything. But do you really want 26 to be the age of majority for everything? How old were you when you got married?
27.
Huh, I was 28. What do you know?
But you see, it's not just a question of protecting these people because their brains are still developing. You don't want them drinking or smoking or whatever it is. It also works in the other direction, which is, should we hold them fully responsible for their decisions, given that in 5 years' time, their brains will be more developed and they'll be, at least in some sense, different people than they are now?
Sure. And I'll point out a couple of things here, I think. I was subjected to this sort of thing. I had to live with the consequences of some bad decisions I made. And I know a lot of other people, matter of fact, everybody I know will say that to one degree or another, right? Very few of us live charmed lives. But we are still looking at people who we're not sure what to do with them. And yet, if a 13-year-old in many jurisdictions across the country goes out and kills someone in cold blood, we're going to charge that kid with murder and we're going to try him as an adult. Was his brain fully developed? No. There's a dead man on the floor, which seems to matter. So we're always going to be left with these prickly outliers. And I don't know which kind of outliers I want here, because if you err on one side, you get a very different kind. What are we supposed to conclude? And now I'm not so sure, beyond the fact that it seems that an age of majority is incredibly tricky. You and I talked about this once before, and I believe it was on a Words and Numbers Live that we did on a college campus. And I remember getting a lot of pushback. A lot of people sent hate mail saying, what the hell is wrong with you guys? Of course, this is the correct answer, or that is. And even the hate mail wasn't aligned in one direction or the other.
No one can agree. And I would say that they can't agree on the age of majority, not only across individuals, but I don't think we can internally be consistent. Because if you ask the question, how old should someone be to be able to make the decision to drink or to smoke for himself? How old should he be to be able to make the decision to marry, to enter into contracts, to go to war?
I would be relieved if we chose 21 years as the age of majority across the board. I think that splits the difference. Now, that would interact with driving in a very bad way. Young people need to be able to drive to get to jobs that they need to have. So I don't know. All of a sudden, I've got an exception. And then we've got constitutional language saying that 18 is the age to vote, which means we'd have to have a constitutional amendment to overturn that. Okay, so now we've got two exceptions. Congratulations, we're right back where we started. Even as you say something like young people shouldn't be held fully responsible for their actions, I can't help but say, no, they actually should be.
There's a weird thing there, because I can agree with you. People should be held responsible for their actions. But the weirdness comes in when you're dealing with someone, let's say a 15-year-old, and you hold him responsible for his actions, but then come 20, because of this development, I don't know that he's the same person. And so now, in some sense, you're holding somebody different responsible for someone else's actions. I know I made decisions as a young person that today are appalling to me.
Sure.
I would never make such a decision, and yet it raised the question, should I, the old aunt, be held responsible for something that the young aunt did when the old aunt agrees with you 100% that the young aunt had no business doing that?
I get it. You're running headlong into Eastern philosophy here. What is the nature of the self? There's this nice Buddhist example that you can think about. Think of your life as a wrap of reeds that a man is carrying. And as he walks, he picks up more reeds and he shoves them into his quiver. And the more he shoves in, every now and then one falls out. As he keeps going, by the time he's at his final destination, it's pretty clear that he's got a lot of reeds and none of them might have been in his container at the beginning of his journey.
Right.
So, okay, you're the reeds. I did a Smoking Stories about this. I'll give you a link in the show notes for those of you lazy people who didn't watch it. I looked at rock bands in which all of the original members were gone, and yet they still tour.
Right, yes.
What the hell is that, right? But part of me wants to be as serious as a heart attack about this and say that I don't really give a shit that you somehow in your dotage have come to think that what you did at age 16 was stupid. Yeah, sure, we all did stupid things. But by your analysis, it might be the case that you wouldn't be willing to hold somebody accountable in the form of childcare payments. Do you think they shouldn't have to make good on that? It's yet another outlier.
We're back to the problem. There's no clean answer to this question. When is an adult and when is not an adult?
That's right. There isn't. Society held me accountable for a number of my problems, a number of my actions. And yet my parents still said, all right, we'll see you back at the house. They understood that I was probably not making adult decisions because I was probably not an adult.
Yeah.
And yet the judge always treated me as an adult. I remember one time we went to court with a friend of mine and his mother got up and stood next to him. He was 18 and stood next to him when the judge was about to address him. And the judge yelled at her and said, ma'am, you go sit right back down. Your son is an adult in the eyes of the court.
We've been talking about this from the perspective of protecting young people because they're developing, or should they be held accountable for decisions they made later in life. I want to look at it from a different perspective, and that is, there are instances in which we broadly, take advantage of young people precisely because of this. I point to the age of draft, 18. You turn 18 in the United States, you're a male, you can be drafted under the law. Now, here's the thing. The same research that shows that human brains are still developing into their 20s will also show you that young people particularly have a short time horizon. That is, when they think about the future, they don't think long term like you or I would, or an older person would. They're thinking in months.
When I was 16, long term was Friday.
Right. Now, economists would say it in technical language that they have a high discount rate. That is, that they discount the future by a tremendous amount.
Yep.
They're looking short term. So here's the thing. If I wanted to send a bunch of my citizens off to war, who am I going to pick? I'm going to pick the citizens who don't have a long-term outlook, who are only looking at the immediate. And so in that sense, I'm taking advantage of them.
I'm sure some people thought about it that way. But more to the point, they're young, which means their bodies are hard and can do much more strenuous things than somebody even 10 years older could hope to do. Beyond that, they're not that savvy. They tend to take orders better than somebody 10 years older. And for those reasons, I think that's the group I would go after, too.
And I don't disagree with you. I just point out the fact that the young people will push back less because their time horizons are short.
The draft was a very recent memory when you and I were young. It had just wrapped up. And yet, when we look to Israel, every citizen of Israel serves at age 18.
Yeah, male and female.
That's much different from what we had as a draft. There was no way we were ever going to say that every single 18-year-old had to serve.
From time to time, I'll see students in front of me who have spent a couple of years in the military, and they are way beyond, in terms of maturity,
light years,
the other students there. And so it kind of raises the question, what's the causality here? On the one hand, we've been talking about shielding these young people until they become old enough to know what they're doing. On the other hand, maybe throwing them into the fire matures them.
I can tell you what I have always done, and I've done it because I lived the opposite way and paid for it dearly. I exert authority over them so that they can develop self-discipline. That's what the former soldiers bring to your class. How do you know? They sit in the front. They sit up straight. They've got a book open. It's open to the right page. You see the notes in the book. You know they do all the homework because they score very highly on all the quizzes and tests. And what is that? That's the discipline you want everyone to have. Are they the smartest students in the room? Not necessarily, but they're the most disciplined.
Right.
So they get the most out of it. And their performance is, on balance, much higher. I loved my ROTC guys, my retired military guys. They brought a level of seriousness to the class that I could occasionally stop class, point at them and say, why are the rest of you not like him? Self-discipline for me is the key to everything. I had no success in life until I figured that out.
But then there's this weirdness if you go back a couple of centuries. Think about Jefferson and Madison and Adams and Washington. My God, they were 20-year-olds. Some of them maybe 30. I think Franklin was the outlier.
Jefferson was 33 when he wrote the Declaration of Independence, which is, I think, the most important document that the world has ever seen.
Yeah.
He made me feel like a loser when I was 33, and then every year a little more so from that point forward. I don't think many of them were in their 20s, but they were young. And yet their life expectancy was much lower, so they were all probably technically middle-aged wherever they sat. Ben Franklin was a weird example. He was 80.
Yeah.
How do you get to be 80 in the 18th century?
It's not like he lived a healthy lifestyle.
No, quite the opposite. And reveled in it, which is why we all kind of like him. I think I'm left where I was before we started talking about this. And where that was looking at a bunch of arbitrary lines that we've drawn to determine when they can be responsible for certain things. 16, you drive. 18, you vote. 21, you drink. It just seems so ridiculous.
For all the emphasis that particularly libertarians put on rights, we're all pretty quick to squelch the rights of children, of minors.
No, that's right. And here's where the libertarian crowd, I think, generally goes very wrong, or at least a significant number of them, when they say that children are the property of their parents. You don't own people, right? We've got words for that, and that's not what children are. Maybe I'll tell the story in the bonus episode that we're about to record in just a minute. So those of you who are keenly interested in this, go ahead, join the Patreon, and we'll talk to you later. You just can't treat children that way.
One thought that occurs to me every time I go down this path is the question, what would happen if we left the age of majority variable? That is, each person gets to decide for himself. I decide today,
that's
I'm now going to be...
terrible idea.
Well, that's... maybe, maybe not. Because what goes with that decision are both rights and responsibilities. If you decide, okay, I'm now an adult, then you get the rights that go with being an adult. You can smoke, you can drink, you can drive, you can do whatever. But also the responsibilities. So you're going to be held to contracts. You break the law, the full weight of the law comes down upon you. And let people decide on their own.
That would be a terrible thing. Because what you would get is a bunch of 14-year-olds saying, well, where do I sign? Where do I get the beer? Where's my car? Where's the weed? Let's go have a great night. And a bunch of young people are going to die. One of the reasons why we keep them from these sorts of activities.
Yeah, you've got a meta problem.
Yeah.
Which is they aren't mature enough to be able to decide whether they're mature.
That's exactly right. That is literally the exact right observation. I get nervous when grown adults start drinking.
Mm-hmm.
They always become wild cards. There's a few days every year, three, that are really, really big nights for the bars. New Year's Eve, it's St. Patrick's Day, and it's the Wednesday before Thanksgiving, believe it or not. Three biggest bar days in the year. I learned this when I was a DJ at a dance club. What I learned was on those 3 days, people who didn't drink much as a rule went out and got hammered. And they were the people who caused the problems after the bars closed. Regular drinkers who drink themselves stupid at a bar can almost always get home without killing themselves or other people. That's why they don't get caught. When they get caught, we make a big deal out of it, and I think we should. But they don't get caught very often because they can fill out the blanks in their minds. They get home. Would I legislate that into existence? I most certainly would not. Let's keep the drunks off the roads. But it's the amateurs that'll kill you. And how many amateurs would you have if we broke in some other direction? My God, it would be so many more. And it would be all kinds of people who are far too young for it. We all know that. We moved the drinking age from 18 to 21. And we did it. And do you think even for a second that that was a mistake? I don't like the way we got it, withholding highway funds. We're playing fast and loose with constitutional abilities, the presidential office. Nonetheless, I wouldn't change it if I could change all the laws tomorrow. We're left at the end with no clear answer, at least no answer that's any better than the one we started with, which is a mishmash of all things. That's all the time we've got this week on Words and Numbers. Join us next week at noon on Wednesday for something brand new and probably more exciting than what we just had. Until then, join us on Words and Numbers Backstage, the Facebook group where the conversation continues. Find us on Twitter. Handles are in the show notes. And
stop by our new website, wordsandnumbers.org, and send us email, wordsandnumberspodcast@gmail.com.
Until next week, just be nice to each other. It doesn't take all that much. The whole world would be better if you were just a little nicer to each other. Catch you later, Ant.
See you next week, James.